behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben.
Ben, today's topic is a listener suggestion. We love listener suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Right? Some of our best ideas come from listeners.
Absolutely, because sometimes we just feel kind of tapped out. I mean, we've covered so many things over the past, what, 6+ years?
Mm-hmm.
There are times when we get into a little lull, and we're kind of, I don't know, spitballing ideas back and forth between us. And
we've done all of them.
Exactly right. And then, you know, we think, well, let's check out our listener mail. And lo and behold, there's a fantastic idea somewhere within listener mail. And that happens a lot. So please keep sending those in, because today's topic is evidence of that.
Yes. Costa B writes into us, and we hope we're pronouncing your first name correctly. And Costa says, today I searched the Car Stuff website and noticed that you have not had an episode on the Citroën car from France.
Yeah.
And he goes on to say, Costa goes on to say, back in the day, around 1992, my family went on a road trip throughout Europe in a Citroën BX16. It was the perfect European road trip car. It could handle the German Autobahn, and thanks to their proprietary hydropneumatic suspension, it could handle going off the beaten path near Mount Olympus in Greece.
And that is a feature that we're going to cover, by the way, the hydropneumatic suspension. So hold your breath for that one.
Yes. And Costa, I love the ending of this email, says, I'm wondering if you guys will ever cover this funky French car. I know it was far from perfect, but it definitely has its own character.
You know, the thing about these cars, Ben, and we're here in the United States saying this, and there's going to be reasons, or we'll explain the reason why we're not as familiar with Citroën cars as the rest of the world is. Or Citroën or Citroën.
Citroën.
Is Citroën, right?
Yeah.
The right way to say it?
Let's just keep rotating through all the pronunciations.
You know what? I know that I will. I'll try. I'll try my best to do it the proper way, which is Citroën. But, yeah, this is a good point. I mean, it is kind of a funky French car, and it does have kind of a cult following here in the United States.
Oh, sure.
It never really got beyond that here, because it was just offered in such limited numbers in North America. And, you know, there's a few around. I see a few. I
mean, sure, every now and then.
Very, very rarely. I mean, I can tell you maybe, oh, boy.
You could probably count on both hands.
No, one hand maybe even, the number of them I've seen. Even at car shows here, I've got very little experience with them. There's one that that drives around Roswell, Georgia. It's a 2CV. So the kind of looks like in layman's terms, looks like the Volkswagen Beetle.
Sure.
The old Beetle design. And then there's also one that, I didn't know I've mentioned this, Ben, in the past. When I was in high school, there was a girl that went to our high school that, her family, they had won a Citroën in a radio contest. And it was parked alongside the garage, you know, near her house there. And it was always covered up with a tarp, or halfway covered up with a tarp. But you could sometimes catch a glimpse of it, and that was about it. I mean, that's really my only experience with Citroëns here in the United States. They just aren't plentiful like they would be anywhere else.
Yeah, and I love that you say anywhere else, because it's a weird thing that you and I found. The Citroën is incredibly popular throughout the rest of the world. But as you said, going back to its status as an import car, I think, in North America, that really restricted the ability of car buyers to purchase it. And there's sort of this catch-22 with a popular car sometimes. You know, you have to see it around to decide if you want to get one, but somebody has to get one for you to see it around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, it's just not there.
It's just not there.
It's not there for us anyways, but the rest of the world, sure it is. And we'll talk about why it is when we get to it, but just to give you an idea of how big of a car company Citroën is right now, well, actually, it's PSA Peugeot Citroën. Not to give anything away, but
yeah, we'll get to that part.
We have to make sure that we mention that up front, I think. So PSA Peugeot Citroën, they sold something like 2.9 million units in 2012, and that was enough to make them the second largest Europe-based automaker. And it gets even better than that, Ben. If you want to count them on a worldwide scale.
Let's go for it.
They're the 9th largest automaker in the world, measured in unit production, if you want to go that way. And, sure. But that was in 2009. I couldn't find numbers more current than that that tells me, you know, where they place or where they rank worldwide.
Those numbers can be a bit slow sometimes. There's a lot to compile. You know what I mean?
Slow is definitely the way it is here with this. Now, there's other stuff that we can cover just before we kind of get into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe just kind of like the, I guess you'd call this the about section, about Citroën.
Yes.
It was founded in 1919.
By a French industrialist, André Gustave Citroën.
Mm-hmm. He passed away in 1935, which we'll also tell you about. And just recently, the brand celebrated its 90th anniversary. It was, you know, 2009, so just about 5 years ago. So they're up to 95 at this point.
They've gone through a lot of changes, though.
Yes, they have. They sure have. And, you know, they were this is the first mass-produced car company outside of the United States. So it's a big deal. I mean, it's got a long history that we'll tell you about. They were pioneers in a lot of modern concepts, and they've created one unique thing here that other automakers didn't do prior to Citroën. They created a sales and service network that complemented the vehicle, which it just seems so basic now. It seems like you would always do that, right? But it wasn't the case up until Citroën did it. And within 8 years, so by 1927, because you remember it was founded in 1919, Citroën had become Europe's largest car manufacturer and the fourth largest in the entire world by 1927. That's remarkable.
Yeah, it's extraordinary for sure. Let's talk just a little bit about André himself.
Yes.
That's cool.
Yes.
But first, let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Scott, as we established earlier, André Gustave was born in 1878. He was the last child, the baby of the family, the fifth kid. His dad was a diamond merchant from the Netherlands. Now, before André was born, they had moved to Paris from Amsterdam, and they changed their name here to give it that, diuresis, or the little umlaut thing over the E.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, his father passed away when André was quite young, and so he became... I don't know, what's the best way to say it? He knew that he would have to make his own way, I think, from a very early age. And as a smart kid, he graduated the École Polytechnique, the Polytechnical University, in 1900. And at the same time, you know, his parents, his mother passed away as well. Hmm. So he didn't have...
It's a rough start.
It is a rough start, but... He visits Poland that year, where his mother was born, and he sees a carpenter working on a set of gears with a fishbone structure. And this guy is an engineer through and through, Scott.
Okay.
So he begins getting his own gears turning, right, in his head. And this brings out one of the big innovations of Citroën, which is the double helical gear. And that's just one of many innovations that Citroën created.
Yeah, in fact, he uses that as part of the logo for the company. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the Citroën logo, you can see the two chevrons.
Yeah, double chevron.
A double chevron, and that is supposed to represent the intermeshing contact of the two gears that we're talking about, this the chevron-shaped gear that was used in milling originally. Mm-hmm. And again, he picks this up at 22. He
bought the patent.
Yeah, he did. He bought the patent to apply it to steel. Mm-hmm. And that's how that works out. So, and that even carries forward through, they've got a new logo for their 90th anniversary. And, they remain with the double chevron. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's kind of nice. I mean, that it throws all the way back to when this guy was 22, just starting out, but he was pretty successful early on because he had a modern factory. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you got to remember that this is during World War I and it's building, armaments for France for the war. So it's building, you know, military weapons. I'm not sure exactly what was going on in his factory, but he has this modern factory. And then he's got this realization that, you know what, someday peace is going to break out, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And what am I going to do with this big modern factory that I've got? I've got to get a plan in place, and it's got to be something that's, going to be profitable, obviously, but, you know, and also provide jobs to the locals, et cetera. And he was trying to think of what am I going to do? And... The idea was that, you know, of course, there's this new thing, the automobile, or relatively new.
Right.
Not
it's
brand
catching
new.
On.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's probably a couple decades old at this point, but it's getting more and more popular. And he's thinking, hey, why not make this place into an automobile factory? And he's already got this idea by about 1916, which is a couple of years before the war ends. And I think he had already asked a guy, an engineer at Panhard.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's name was Louis de France to design what they called a technically sophisticated 18-horsepower automobile that he could possibly build at his factory, you know, once the war ends. And, you know, long before any of that ever happened, you know, before the war ended, he had already decided that that maybe wasn't the way to go. He was looking at guys like Henry Ford over here in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and he saw the way that Ford was, you know, making automobiles that were, you know, of good quality, but also, you know, you could make sufficient quantity of them. So he was looking at the methods that Henry Ford was using.
Yeah, to scale. He said a lighter car that was good quality, but also had to be reproducible enough that you could hit that economy of scale and make the price go down for the average post-war consumer.
Exactly right. And this is really critical because when we talk about the first car that comes out here in just a moment,
mm-hmm.
You know, he sticks with that, that idea. He wants to maintain true to that an original thought. And that is eventually, in a way, the downfall because there's a couple of bankruptcies that we'll talk about.
Right.
And that leads to one of them. So, you know, we said in 1916, he's got this idea for this 18 horsepower car, but in 1917, he contacted another engineer. The guy's name was Jules Salomon.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a good reputation in the French automotive sector. And there were a lot of French automobile companies, by the way.
Oh, yeah, proliferation. Because let's keep in mind that France was a hub of automotive and motorcycle activity, too. Scott, we should also mention that this was not Andre's first time at the automotive rodeo, right? Because he was also in 1906 director for the automotive Moores Company.
I like that same, Ben.
What,
the first time at the automotive rodeo. There's something there. We could play with that.
The pieces are there. Maybe we can fix that up.
Yeah, man. I like it.
Yeah, all right.
We'll fix it
in post, right, Noel? Shout out to our super producer, Noel Brown.
That might be an impossible task at this point. But yeah, so he's already kind of, he's I dipped his toe in the water, I guess.
Right, and now he goes full in with those engineers, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And let's see, he starts making automotive history pretty quickly.
Yeah, because he, you remember I mentioned 1917, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Jules Salomon. Well, this guy, he designed another car in 1909 called the Le Zebre.
Le Zebre.
Yeah, I think I'm getting this right. And there's a lot of French pronunciations here, but he comes to this guy with a lot of demands. And this is an unusual one, Ben. He's dropped the horsepower down to 10 horsepower.
Yep.
And he says it has to be a brand new design, 10 horsepower, that's going to be better equipped, more robust, and less costly to produce than any rival product at the time.
And lo and behold.
So that's his market, right?
Yeah.
And he comes out with what they call the Type A.
Yeah, just 4 months after the close of World War One in March 1919, they debut the Type A. It comes out at the end of May. It's exhibited in June. It's at a place that usually sells Alda cars. But they persuaded the guy who owned the business to let them use the showroom just for a little bit.
Isn't that something? So they said, we'd just like maybe this corner to exhibit this Type A. And the guy probably said, you can do whatever you like, I guess. I mean, we'll charge you rent for it probably, right?
Sure.
By the foot or whatever.
Yeah.
But eventually this thing started to take off. And, it, you know, it wasn't too much longer before he sold his first vehicle because I think we said that, you know, June was when they first came out with this vehicle, right?
Yeah.
Is that right, June? Or am I making that up?
No. You're right. It was exhibited at the showroom in June. The first actual delivery to a customer was July 7th, 1919. Top speed of this, by the way, I'm sure a lot of people want to hear that because they heard horsepower. The top speed of this 10 horsepower car is about 65 kilometers per hour.
Yeah, that's not bad.
That's not bad.
I mean, I'm going to guess here. Is that like 40 some miles per hour maybe? Is that right?
Roundabout.
That's got to be ballpark, right?
Yeah.
All right. So that same year, now this is amazing. Just on the heels of him launching his first brand new car in 1919, this Type A, he starts to, you know, Andre Citroën starts to negotiate with General Motors here in the United States. Now, you got to remember that General Motors is basically a new car company at this point because they were founded in about 1908. So they're only like 11 years on at this point. But they're talking to Citroën about possibly buying out the nameplate. They're saying, we like what you're doing with the Type A.
Yeah.
It might be an in for us in the European market.
However, they ultimately could not reach an agreement because from what I understand, the concern really came from General Motors. They were a little bit worried that they would be stretching themselves too thin with the investment that would take.
Well, makes sense. I mean, here they are. They're relatively new at this point. They can't just go around buying and selling companies
across the ocean
like they do now, right?
So, shots fired,
or Scott. they did at least. Not so much. Okay. Anyways, let's move on from that point. So, one thing that he was good at. Now, of course, he said that the negotiations did fall apart. Obviously, they did not work out. A plan between them, so it didn't work out. And there was also something that Andre was really good at. He was good at marketing his own product.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, exceptional at marketing his own product, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was almost a one-man band in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. He was the showman as well as the business end. Here's the thing. André Gustave Citroën is a little bit like Tony Stark in that, he's got a little bit of flash. He's got a little flair. He likes to live dangerously. We'll talk about the gambling eventually.
Okay.
But just spoiler alert for everybody listening. This guy is a personality. You know what I mean? And so he, in some ways, in the early days of Citroën, he is part of the brand.
I never expected an Iron Man reference in this episode.
I feel that it is apt. Also,
probably is apt. You're right. Yeah. You're right. So, we mentioned that he's really, really good at marketing, right? And he's kind of this big, bold character, as you say. In fact, he's so bold that he decides to use, get this, Ben, the Eiffel Tower as the world's largest advertising sign. And you can go and find photos of this if you'd like to, because between the years of, 1925 and 1934, so for 9 years, the letters Citroën were up and down the Eiffel Tower in lights every evening. And it's huge. I mean, it goes from the top to at least looks like more than midway down. I mean, it's enormous advertising, a huge billboard in lights in Paris in 1925.
9 years.
9 full years. Now that's pretty big. I mean, that's, again, I think it still holds the world record, the Guinness World Record for the largest advertisement.
And during this time, they're also making different types of cars too. They didn't just keep reiterating the Type A. There's the 1923 Type C, which is not a bad car. It was the first car to be driven around Australia.
Oh, yeah, this is big. And it's a tough car, too, Ben. I mean, to drive around Australia, now think about this. Even now, there's desolate places in Australia, right?
Right. Oh, remember that episode we did on road trains in Australia?
Oh, yeah. Those guys, they get way out in the middle of nowhere, and there's no stopping them. They just keep going. That was a fun episode. That was a really good one. But imagine Australia in 1923, just how desolate some of those areas are.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first car to drive completely around Australia. The trip took 5 months. Back in 1925. That's how difficult it was to make this trip. 5 months.
August to December.
Yeah, amazing. So they're really tough cars. And he was doing other unusual things, too. Like they were putting these track systems on cars to allow them to cross what they called inhospitable areas, like maybe sand dunes or just jungle-type terrain. These are called Kegress track system vehicles. And you can picture these probably in your mind. They've got a track system at the rear of the vehicle. And in the front, they would often fit skids or skis of some kind. Sometimes it would just be wheels, but it was more than likely skis. These vehicles used a kind of rubber or canvas continuous track, which used a flexible belt instead of like the interlocking metal segments like you'd find on a regular tank.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a metal track system. It's more either rubber or canvas.
Now, this conveyed scientists and journalists. This was sort of seen as an innovation that allowed allowed the civilized world to explore the wilds on the edges of the map. And he took this across several continents, and you and I were talking about this off air. He had names for these that would be wildly inappropriate today.
And should we say them, man?
Let's just say them.
Let me tell you, this is the 1920s.
True.
And this is the guy that's, he's sponsoring these expeditions across different regions and different areas. And it's a little bit insensitive now looking back, but this is just what he did back then in the 1920s. It was kind of the way it was, really. I mean, we're just reporting the news, right?
Yeah.
All right. So these expeditions, just for example, he had an expedition that went across Asia, and he called that the Yellow Journey.
Right, and he had an expedition across North America, which he called the White Journey.
Yep, and then he had one across Africa, and he called that the Black Journey. So you can see that, you know, it's maybe not, you know, the most culturally sensitive thing
absolutely
to name
not,
these
yeah
journeys or these expeditions.
And would he say when he got to Antarctica, because he already used White Journey?
I don't know. The Antarctica? I would say the penguin squishing
journey.
Journey? I don't know.
I just feel like it was bad marketing on his part. But actually, as we know, as history shows, this Kegris track was enormously impressive. And at the time, this guy is making serious moves because they're still building cars, right? In 1924, they partner up with an American named Edward Budd, right?
Yeah, Edward Budd. And that name you may recall from when we talked about the Budd Company. Which was, and I think right now that's based in Troy, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not always there. I can't remember exactly where it was, but Budd Company was the company that would build these stainless steel bodies for railroad cars. In fact, the Pullman cars that a lot of people can probably picture in their mind, those stainless steel, train cars,
mm-hmm,
those were Budd Company vehicles designed by, you know, the founder, Edward G. Budd. And, let's see, I think Dodge was Budd's first big client because, you know, they were kind of new to the game of building just, not stainless, but steel bodies.
Right.
I remember we talked about them going from the switchover from wood to steel, and the Dodge brothers were kind of early on with that, right? So
mm-hmm,
the Dodge was Budd Company's first big client. And I think it was in the October 1924 Paris Motor Show, I think it was, Ben.
Yeah.
That Citroën introduced the Citroën B10. Which is the first all-steel body in Europe.
Ah.
And that was because of his relationship with Budd Company founder Edward G. Budd.
And it was successful at first, but the other guys in the game got wind of this and said, hey, why are we using wooden structures like a bunch of suckers? Let's redesign our bodies. Citroën did not, however. They still sold in large quantities despite not changing it. And the thing was that the car's low price, the car's we must be crazy to make deals like this price, actually was kind of crazy, and the company started taking losses on every car they sold.
Yeah, he decided that, you know, affordable was the way that he wanted to go, and, you know, not necessarily styling was what he needed to focus on. And unfortunately, the buying public didn't think that way. They thought, well, these cars look great. I'm going to spend a little bit more money for something that looks a little better at this point.
Yeah.
And it didn't turn out so well for him because, in 1927, he had to ask for some help from a bank,
mm-hmm,
and they finally renegotiated his debt around a little bit.
Lazard, the bank was Lazard, right?
Lazard, yep, that's right. And in 1933, they introduced a new vehicle called the Rosalie. And the Rosalie we should go back and talk about first in just a minute.
Yeah.
But the Rosalie was the first commercially available passenger car with a diesel engine.
Right. They partnered with Harry Ricardo, mm-hmm, to build this.
Now, Harry Ricardo, he was an early and legendary engine designer and researcher from the very earliest days of internal combustion.
Yeah, I'm surprised he hasn't popped up more often in the show.
You know, I am too. Maybe we could even have a podcast about Harry Ricardo, rather.
I'm writing it down.
Maybe that's probably a good idea. But again, this is the first commercially available passenger car with a diesel engine. It's the 1933 Citroën Rosalie.
Well, you know what, Scott? While we're talking about the Rosalie and innovations, it occurs to me that this is going to need to be a two-part episode.
Oh, but, yeah, because even just the list of innovations is long here. I'd like to get into it.
Let's do the list of innovations as the one last thing for this one.
Oh,
and
sure.
Then we'll come back with I don't want to give you guys a cliffhanger out there listening to the show, but we will do some innovations, and then we're just going to have to come back because we still both have so much stuff about Citroën.
Yeah, pretty fascinating stuff. I mean, the company goes through a lot of twists and turns,
mm-hmm,
throughout the years,
mm-hmm,
and we still haven't talked about why it's not in the United States. I mean,
right.
There's a lot out there.
We haven't
still
talked about what happened to Andre.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's a sad story. Okay.
All right, well, let's end up on an up note, and we can go back and forth with some of these innovations. We already mentioned the first commercially available passenger car with a diesel engine.
Exactly right. So, going along with this history of innovation that the company has, they also introduced the first industrial mass production of vehicles outside of the United States. Remember we talked
right
about how he looked up to Henry Ford and his way of doing things as kind of a template for him.
Now, I know we might have to qualify this, but they also, if they did not invent monocoque design, they definitely popularized it.
Yeah, that's right, because they introduced, we'll call it one of the first cars to feature a monocoque-type body.
Yeah.
And that was pretty important, right? And then there's another thing here. Actually, there's several. We mentioned the first all-steel body, remember, the B-10.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a vehicle that they had, they called the Traction Avant, they introduced the world's first mass-produced front-wheel drive car.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah, it's tough to really get across how big of a deal that is.
Mm-hmm. And another one that we're going to come up to here in part two, I'm sure. In 1954, they produced the world's first hydropneumatic self-leveling suspension system, and that's a big deal.
Which is what Costa was writing to us about.
You're exactly right. Yeah, so we're going to get to that, I promise, in part two. Also, the first European production car with disc brakes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this goes on and on and on. I mean, there's what else? Swiveling headlights that we talked about in just a recent episode. You remember
that?
Yeah,
we did. That's from new car technology that isn't new.
Yeah, but you remember they weren't first.
They were not first.
They were the second one to do that, mm-hmm. because that Czech Tatra vehicle from 1935.
I'm still amazed by that.
Very strange. All right, so, you know, there's a lot of firsts. There's a lot of interesting vehicles coming up in part two, and some more history about, you know, the founder and the company itself and where it is now. So, you know, listen up for part two.
Yeah, and we hope that you are enjoying our series on the Citroën, despite our variable pronunciations of the French. Check us out. Do us a favor and check us out on Facebook and Twitter, where we're CarStuffHSW. Help support one of your maybe favorite car shows. I don't know. Maybe we're up there.
Maybe in the top 10.
Yeah, and if you're on the fence about that, go check out carstuffshow.com, where you have every single episode that we have ever done. And if you want to take a line from Costa's book and send us an email directly, now's the time. Our address is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.